Moxie. This shit's pretty good. This stuff's pretty good.
Man.
We all want to live our life, but we don't all know how. I used to be so adrift in the world, not knowing who I was. Those were hard years. I thought I would never get out of that vicious cycle of self-doubt. But I soon learned how to unleash my real self. Now I am the master of my own destiny, the writer of my own story, and I owe it all to Moxie.
Moxie. This shit's pretty good. I want to try that Moxie. Hold on. Let me go get it. Now, New Hampshire. Years ago, you used to say somebody had Moxie. Meant that they would, you know, they had it going on. They were tough or whatever. And this is some kind of soft drink from up yonder in Yankee Land. New Hampshire. Moxie says distinctively different. Well, I'll tell you what. Apparently it's just some kind of super duper soft drink. It's 150 calories in a can.
Good God.
Produced under the authority of the Moxie Beverage Company in Bedford, New Hampshire. All right. Well, I ain't never had Moxie before. He said there's two kinds of people. In this world. People can't stand this crap. And people that can barely tolerate it. Well, I'll tell you what. All right. So here's a Southerner's first taste of Moxie. All right. Well, I'll tell you what. Man. I hope that don't mean I'm turning into a darn Yankee. This shit's pretty good. Man, it's like a Coca-Cola. Well, I'll tell you what, Scott. All right, maybe a clove flavoring added to it. Moxie. Well, I'll tell you what. Next time I'm up there in Yankee Land, I'll get me some of this. This stuff's pretty good. God, I hope this don't mean I'm turning into a darn Yankee. Down here where I'm from, you know how you can tell the difference? You know the difference in a Yankee and a damn Yankee? Well, a Yankee will come down and visit. A damn Yankee will come down here and stay. Moxie. Well, I'll tell you what. This shit is pretty good. This stuff's pretty good.
Happy Sunday, everybody. This is the Plants Are People 2 podcast, episode 19. Greg Nelson from San Diego, California, is with us to share his knowledge about having container-grown bog gardens or an in-ground sort of bog garden somewhere on your property or your back porch. Some really cool species that you have the potential of growing. And our intro today, my favorite soda in the world, Moxie. If they're hearing this and they want to actually sponsor the show, I will take that under consideration. One of my favorite sodas ever. And so I shipped one to Greg for him to try on air for the first time. And he got it right before we spoke for this episode, so he got to try that. And if you want to reach out, you can find me on Instagram, plants.r.people.2, or you can email plantsarpeople2podcast@gmail.com, and I will get back to you. Hope you're enjoying the episodes. Thanks for listening, and have a good rest of the weekend. Bye.
My name's Greg Nelson. I got into carnivorous plants about 3 years ago. I went to a carnivorous plant sale here in San Diego, California. It's at Balboa Park, one of kind of the highlights of San Diego County itself. And it's run by the San Diego Carnivorous Plant Society. And so I had heard about it through a mutual person through Instagram and thought I would check it out. Went there, and it always been kind of in the back of my mind, like it would be fun to grow them. So I went there, came back with two North American pitcher plants, two tropical pitcher plants, and a Venus flytrap. And then kind of from there, my collection grew, and I wanted to kind of like mimic, you know, bogs and stuff, kind of create a variety of plants in one. And I got interested in kind of like some of the companion plants that grow with them too, like yellow-eyed grass and like the juncus and some of the bog orchids and all of that. And so, it's kind of just spiraled from there. And I pretty much grow outside all of my carnivorous plant bogs and also Drosophyllum, the dewy pine. And then inside is where I grow my tropical pitcher plants. I grow them in a cabinet that kind of converted into a terrarium, just to try to give them ideal conditions. So right now I'm at four, what I like to call just mini bogs that I have outside. And each of them kind of has a different variety of plants within them.
How did you decide what varieties to put in each one?
Oh, gosh. That's a good question. So, let's see. So, I tried to almost... So, the first one, which is comprised of the Sarracenia, and it has a Drosera filiformis tracii in it as well. And there's about, let's see, one, two, three, four different varieties of Sarracenia. I think three of them are hybrids, and one is a species, Leucophylla. And I kind of created that one with kind of more like a design aspect in mind. So I have kind of the Sarracenia in the back for the height, and then I put some smaller plants in front. And that was kind of my idea last season when I did it for the first growing season. But now it's kind of, you know, there's yellow-eyed grass popping up, which creates height kind of in front. So now I'm kind of just going for a naturalistic approach with that one. One of the other ones I have, the middle, there's kind of a line of fly traps in that one. In the background, I have Cape Sundews, Drosera capensis. In the front, I have a different variety of pygmy sundews, which I really love. They're really fun to just kind of see them spread after their winter gemma production. And then there's like a little strip in the back that's kind of blank right now. There's a bonata that's coming back from dormancy that's starting to pop up. So that, as that gets taller, kind of create that same kind of higher, mid, and low kind of aspect. And that one's kind of keeping that kind of design approach to it. The third one that I did is more of like a flooded type of bog. So I have the pot within a larger pot that's also higher. And so I can easily flood it. And that one has the parrot pitcher plant, Sarracenia citicina, has some cranberries, some bog button, has some juncus, water spider orchid, and I think this is Pinguicula plantifolia as well. Mm. And then the fourth and last one kind of didn't have much of a design aspect to it as far as aesthetics. Is more of like an inspirational one. So I have family in northern Minnesota over kind of by Bemidji. And so we went to the bog out there, the Bemidji one, and I was just kind of inspired by a lot of the species and other plants that grow out there. So I have Sarracenia purpurea in here. I have some Drosera rotundifolia. I have bog cranberry in here, some of the grass orchids, another two other orchids, I can't remember what they are, and also a bog blackberry as well.
In there. Are the grass orchids spiranthes?
It's a good question. So it's like a pink grass orchid. I would have to double check.
Yeah,
pink grass orchid. And I think the white variety too of it.
Is it Calopogon tuberosa? Grass pink orchid.
Yes. Yeah. That might be it.
Yeah, those are pretty. Yeah. All of these plants that you're talking about, like the Pinguicula, and I was just looking up a bunch of different carnivorous plants that occur sort of where I am, mm-hmm. just to get a reference point. And they're all, a lot of the ones around me are endangered. We have plenty of Drosera species.
Mm-hmm.
There's probably about five of them.
Oh, wow.
The Pinguicula is rare. In almost everywhere that it occurs. The Sarracenia, we have one species, Purpurea.
Yeah.
And we have things like the bladder warts or the Utricularias.
Mm-hmm.
And the other one that I found really interesting was I watched this show recently, or as a documentary on snowdrops.
I don't know. Oh, yes, those are really pretty.
Yeah, they are really pretty, and they're like one of the first spring flowers to come up around here, and probably most places. They're from like the Caucasus Mountains.
Okay.
And there's a ton of different species of them, but they're harvested for the like commercial sale. And there's this underground market for snowdrops of all these different color morphs and different species, and people are collecting these mostly in Holland and Europe.
Mm-hmm.
But when I looked up the Dionea, that's the Venus flytrap.
Yeah.
Those are all almost, in their native range, they're all listed as endangered or threatened in some kind.
Right.
And
yeah.
Those are probably collected for, I would imagine that they're threatened because of the commercial trade of the Venus flytraps.
I think that, and I just recently, I think I watched a video on them. I think it might have been through California Carnivores. They're like a huge carnivorous plant nursery here in California. And I guess they also, like, it's a mixture of that and habitat loss from draining of the wetlands out there too.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I did watch this. There was a New England Botanical Society had a video with Alan Weekly. He's one of the botanists. I'm sure that I'm totally mashing what his title is, but he's some really famous botanist from Chapel Hill, North Carolina.
Okay.
And he was talking about species diversity, and there's sort of an inverse correlation between where there's the highest amount of species biodiversity and where there's also conservation efforts going on.
Mm-hmm.
So places like the Southeast, Alabama, Mississippi, South Carolina, all of those places have the highest biodiversity, but the least amount of conservation going on in those states. Some of those states don't even have floras, like a book that somebody could take out and, key out a plant that they find in the wild.
Oh, yeah.
They don't even have any of that stuff recorded. And then you get up into New England and there's, hundreds of years of documentation of what plants have been here. But the other interesting thing that he mentioned that I caught as a little snippet about the Venus flytrap was they had done a study where they were collecting the insects that were getting caught on the glands, the sticky mm-hmm. glands. And there was almost no overlap between the kind of insects that were pollinating those versus the kind of insects that were getting stuck on the leaves or in the traps.
Right.
Which is really interesting. And I don't know that there's a whole lot of information there now, but like that's a really interesting study subject.
Yeah, I mean, my pitcher plants, my Sarracenia, they catch a lot of bees. Even like the fly traps, every now and then they'll catch bees too. But yeah, the Sarracenia, they just kind of pile.
Catch everything, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So sometimes they'll get so full where it's, you know, the bees get in there and they're barely maybe an inch into there. So then I can kind of release that one. Otherwise, it will just be like a persistent buzzing sound coming from the pitcher plants. But yeah, they seem to be really drawn to them.
Yeah. So let's. So we're going to talk a little bit about making one of these bog plantings.
Okay.
And where should we start? You've got the info.
So I guess, first thing I guess that I struggled with was picking out a vessel. So pretty much, you know, how am I going to do this? Because there's different ways that people make them. So you can do one. So how I have mine is I have my container sitting in a rather large kind of like saucer, like the kind you would put underneath pots already, but it's just oversized. I just fill that up with water to just, you know, easy to see the water level, easy to know when I need to refill it. So I did a design before my first one where I had constructed like a PVC pipe type of deal where part of the PVC pipe sticks up from the soil and you just fill that up. I found that to be messy and tedious, and then I didn't know when I needed to fill the water back up. And I did end up having, at one point, my pitchers drooped because it was too dry. So then I switched to the pot sitting in the saucer with just the water in the bottom, and it just constantly, you know, takes up water as it needs it. And I found that for me to be the easiest, least stressful also, just because you can keep tabs on it very easily. And then that way too, you can still pick whatever size pot that you want, depending on, you know, your area. So mine are, I have about two medium ones and two small ones, because I have a patio that I garden out on. And so once you have your pot figured out, you definitely, if you're getting a pot and doesn't have drainage holes in it, then you definitely want to do drainage holes. And I guess another thing too about the pot is I just use like a plastic one. I find it to be the easiest. It's going to, you know, not grow moss or algae on the side like terracotta can sometimes when it's been sitting in water, and also kind of loses its integrity as well. So I find plastic tends to be good. I'm assuming fiberglass would work really well also. I think maybe glazed ceramic, but I haven't tried it. It's an expensive pot to buy for it to just be having sitting in water. Usually you want to kind of display those kind of nice and pretty and all that.
Are they pretty shallow? Are these pots that you're talking about pretty shallow?
Yeah, so three of them are, so they're kind of shallow. So mine, they're round. So they're more of like a round squat pot, as opposed to kind of the more compact kind of columnar type of pots that people usually buy. So they have, you know, a pretty good diameter on the top, and they kind of taper in, but they taper in more of like a spherical type of situation. Just because, I mean, some of the plants, you know, if the roots go through the holes, it's not going to make a big difference. I actually don't even know that I have that issue. I don't ever see roots. I think some of the stuff is pretty shallow rooted. Mm-hmm. And then it's like the utricularias, those, they don't even, I guess, really technically have a root system. They just kind of do what they do. And the one other one where I flood it, so it's in the same type of pot, but then I just put it within a bigger version of that pot.
Hmm.
So that way it sits down in that pot and I can fill up that water level to where it comes and goes above the surface of the soil. Because I have a lot of plants in there that can either tolerate and they love being flooded at times. So that one I was trying to, had a hard time trying to figure out what I was going to do about that, and then kind of landed on the idea of just putting it in a smaller pot and putting that within the bigger pot.
Cool. That's really good. What about, you know, so setting up the, what's the substrate that you're using?
So I use peat moss. And then it's kind of, I mean, it kind of depends, I guess. I kind of, at this point, eyeball, but I always use peat moss as kind of the base. And then, so for my ones with Sarracenia, I think I did like part peat moss with some horticultural sand and some perlite. That just kind of, you know, helps with the airflow of the roots. So, and it helps with the peat moss not stinking so much either in the summertime. Iron's been going by. And then some of my other ones, like my fly trap, I think that's primarily composed of just peat moss and sand. I personally find peat moss and horticultural sand to be perfect. I don't find any kind of, you know, like big differences in my plants that grow and peat moss and perlite versus peat moss and horticultural sand.
Is that a one-to-one?
Usually it's a one-to-one. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Yeah. Because, I mean, I found that most of the ones that are kind of very boggy plants, they just a one-in-one. That way you have, you know, good water retention still, but you still have some sort of kind of aeration factor to it just so the roots don't suffocate too much within the peat moss itself.
Okay, so that sounds pretty easy. Peat moss and horticultural sand. And yep. Horticultural sand is something you can pick up at, like, I don't know what's out on the West Coast, but like an Agway?
Yeah, like any, like a home goods store. So we out here, we have like Home Depot and Lowe's are two big box stores, or you can even go to like a nursery, a local nursery. A lot of them have horticultural sand. Basically you want the horticultural sand because some of, like, if you get like some places have like beach sand or whatever, but that could sometimes contain salt,
yeah,
that the plants aren't gonna like at all. So if you can find horticultural sand at, you know, your local big box store or nursery, then perfect. Otherwise, I know that there's ways to get it online through even like carnivorous plant sellers. Some of the big ones, they sell horticultural sand also. But I find it's pretty readily available at pretty much anywhere I go between big box and nurseries.
Okay. And so after you do this, I guess we should say that carnivorous plants are pretty, they have low requirements for nutrients.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why you're recommending the peat moss and horticultural sand, which sort of mimics the natural habitat that they would be living in.
Right. Right. Yeah.
So the peat moss, is there any pre-treatment to that you would recommend before setting this sort of thing up?
Yeah, so I usually what I will do is I have my big mixing container that I use to mix it up, and I'll put the peat moss in there, and I'll add some distilled water to it and kind of just let it absorb that. Because peat moss is very, I guess the best way to put it is like pillowy. So it goes kind of everywhere when it's dry.
Very hydrophobic.
Very lightweight. Yeah, and hydrophobic too. So I always wet it first, and then I'll add in my sand or my perlite. And then that way too, when it's pre-moistened like that, you'll be able to incorporate the sand or the perlite into it a lot better. It's not going to be one thing sinks to the bottom and kind of isn't a full incorporation of the two mediums together. So I always pre-moisten it. Because I mean, if you don't do that and then you put your plants and you try to soak it, that's going to take a long time to try to rehydrate that peat moss at that point.
Is that like for overnight, like 24 hours or?
I find that I put in the peat moss into the container. I pour my distilled water in and I just agitate it with my hands and kind of squeeze it and all and move it around, and it hydrates pretty quickly for me.
Okay. And then can you just explain why distilled water is important?
Yeah. So, Conervis plants, they don't, you know, uptake nutrients from the soil. They get them. That's why they capture bugs and digest them within itself to get nutrients that way. So if you have tap water, you know, I guess depending on where you're at and what state and also what city, you could have different, you know, levels of minerals or chemicals within your tap water. And I don't know the exact number, so there's like the total dissolved solids number. And if it's like below a certain number, then, and that's your tap water, then you should be fine using it. But if it's high, like here in San Diego, we have a very high tap water, which is why our tap water also tastes disgusting.
Yeah.
That wouldn't be good, because I think the reading is like well over 200. And you don't want all that mineral build up in the soil, because that's going to damage the plant and eventually probably kill it. So distilled water is void of all those minerals and all that. You could also use rainwater if you live in a place that gets a lot of rainfall and you collect it. Or you could also use reverse osmosis water as well.
Okay. So we've got our pot filled with peat moss and horticultural sand, pre-wetted before we put it into our pot. Yep. Now, do you do mostly seed stuff, or are you buying established plants and then putting them into this?
Yeah, so right now I do established plants. At some point I would like to get into trying to grow from seed. I have in the past, but didn't have much luck with it. So I buy established plants, and I pretty much just plug those into where I want them within the bog. You could do seeds as well. Obviously, a lot of the seeds, unless you live somewhere cold and you overwinter them where it's cold enough, you have to stratify a lot of the temperate species. Usually, a lot of people do it in the refrigerators for about 6 weeks, take them out, and then you put them in peat moss and you see if they germinate. And you can do it that way if you're really ambitious about it. And, you know, some people really enjoy growing plants from seeds. I'm more of an instant satisfaction kind of person. and so I pretty much buy my plants as an established plant already and just kind of plug those into there and then just let them kind of grow through the season and, you know, get bigger as the years go by.
The Xeris yellow-eyed grass that you were talking about coming up in your little pots there, were those from seed or were those established plants?
No, so I bought so a lot. I do have a lot of. I mean, it really reseeds itself very readily without you even knowing it. So I have a bunch of little seedlings popping up now, but I bought the main plants online and planted those in. Those were already established. But
Oh, that's
those, I
cool. So
mean,
you're like seeing the full life cycle,
Right.
generations after.
Right. Yeah. And even like I have a bog violet as well, and that thing reseeds itself like no one's business. I have a bunch of little ones popping up. So I guess that's what what grows from seed is kind of just a natural cycle from an already established plant.
And do you have, what are your sources for buying these plants?
Oh, so I have a lot of websites I go to.
Maybe like the top three.
Top three. So where I get a lot of my companion plants, like the yellow-eyed grass, bog violets, and the orchids, those come from Carnivorous Plant Nursery, and they're based out of Massachusetts, I believe. And they have a lot of companion plants. They have Carnivorous plants too. I've bought in a few from there. And they're very reputable. Haven't had any issues with them at all. And then also, California Carnivores, they have really good variety. Every so often they'll have like a companion plant. Like I know they have an orchid. I think it's a like a water stream orchid. I can't quite remember its common name. But they have a big variety of fly traps, a whole bunch of different cultivars of that. Sarracenia, Drosera, Pinguicula, and also like the Nepenthes too. But and then let's see, last one that I buy from pretty regularly is probably Curious Plant, and that they're based in the Midwest. I want to say I think Ohio, and they have a really good selection of sundew. I bought in quite a few of my pygmy sundew from there. And they have fly traps. They have the Sarracenia. They have Pinguicula, but most of them are of the Mexican and Central America variety that wouldn't really fit into a bog. But those are probably my top three that I've bought in from the most. But I mean, there's a bunch of really good, reputable ones too.
I've bought stuff from Carnivorous Plant Nursery before, and recently I bought the sabbatia, or
Oh,
the
yeah.
sabbatia seeds. Those things, I can't wait to see those come up. Have you tried growing those at all?
So I didn't buy the seed. I bought the pre-established plant, of course. And I bought it last year, and it didn't do much. It just kind of sat around. And I think I probably bought it towards the end of summer, so that's probably why. So now it's kind of perking up and starting to grow upwards and stuff. So I'm hoping to get some flowers on it this year.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's a pretty, very interesting, like the waxy, kind of very thick, almost succulent like leaves on it.
Yeah, those are another, they're around here, out on Cape Cod and stuff, but
Oh, okay.
I've never seen one. But the gentian family, it's just really interesting the way that different things look. But down in North
Right.
Carolina and on in South Carolina, I think you can see huge populations of that.
Oh, okay.
But that would be something that I'd want to put in my bog garden. Tell me, just back to the pots, how big are, like, size wise, how big are we talking? How many gallons?
Many gallons? Oh, God. Question. Let me see.
Is
So,
like, I guess maybe we can think about it like this, is bigger better?
I guess it depends on how many plants you want to put in, but I've also found that crowding isn't really an issue with these plants. So even like my big ones, which are probably like the diameter's probably about like a foot and a half across, about. Even those ones, I mean, they're starting to grow in their second full growing season, and their stuff is popping up everywhere now. And I mean, stuff is just growing kind of like next door to other plants. I don't see an issue with that. So even, I feel like you can get a lot of plants even in a smaller one. So like the smaller one that I have, which is probably maybe about a foot instead of a foot and a half. I mean, that has a Sarracenia in it, has some yellow-eyed grass popping up. It's going to have orchids. But I mean, the rotundifolia, they don't really take up much room since they're so minuscule. So I guess it just depends on, you know, how much you want, the size of the pot, how, because sometimes if you have a big pot, it's going to be a great kind of like, almost like centerpiece kind of display. But I think it just really depends on how many you want growing in there, because I feel like it can take a lot of plants and they can really fill in the space without a lot of overcrowding issues.
Yeah, so, I guess that a bigger one would also have to be watered less, probably.
I would think so, yeah. Yeah. I mean, and it really just depends on, I guess, where you live too. So if you get summer rains and stuff, then you really probably wouldn't even need to water them that often. But like for me out here in San Diego, we have pretty dry, or not so much dry summers, but summers without rain. So that's usually when I'm filling it up the most. And then we have pretty wet winters every now and then, not this year, but that's usually when I have to fill it up less. So it just kind of depends on your climate, your rainfall, how much you're going to have to fill it back up. But I even find like my larger size ones are easy just to, you know, top off the water every day, even during like the peak of the summer. So I think if you keep up kind of that maintenance water level on it, then it should be pretty easy to go.
Are you considering, like, have you mixed species before? Or are you keeping them pretty, you know, in line with the other species that they would be around in a native habitat?
So I guess my Minnesota, northern Minnesota bog is kind of more particular like that. But my other ones are kind of more like a hodgepodge, I guess. I guess the Sarracenia has like the Drosera filiformis tracii in it, which I think comes from Florida. I'm not quite sure about that. And I mean, some of the companion plants, they might differ, but it's like I have like Cape sundews from South Africa with, you know, fly traps that are from the Carolinas. And then I have Utricularia levita in this one, which I believe is from Central or South America, or actually I think it's from Africa too. And then I have the Sabbatia in that one too. So that one's kind of like a hodgepodge, and I have the Pygmy Drosera in that one from Australia. So I guess it just depends on, I guess, the aesthetic, but it's kind of fun with the mixed pot, because when the Venus flytraps go dormant, the Pygmy sundews usually start to look their best because they usually go dormant in the summer for me. And then like right now it's spring coming up, the utriculares are really pushing out a lot of flowers. And then the Cape sundews, those just, they look good throughout the year. It doesn't get, we don't get frost where I am at in San Diego, my part. So those grow year round pretty fully. So I guess that's what's nice with the variety, is you have different plants doing different things throughout the season, whereas like my one with just Sarracenia and the temperate sundew, those all go dormant, and there's not much going on in that one.
Do you have any, I guess this is kind of a silly question maybe, but do you have any insect problems with those?
aphids every now and then, but I find that they are attracted to usually more so like the orchids, and also when my Pinguicula planifolia bloomed recently, they were on the flower stem of that, but I don't really notice much pest problems with mine.
Yeah, I was just, I mean, it just crossed my mind because I brought in like stupidly a cilantro and a basil plant from like the supermarket, and I put them in with my, you know, all my other plants, and there was aphids on them. So I've been sort of dealing with an aphid problem for a little bit.
Yeah.
But then I was thinking, you know, if I had a pot in here, living in the Northeast, we obviously get a winter where,
right,
you know, there's 5 months of freezing. So that is one question for you is, you know, in terms of species, if I had a pot that I set up as a bog garden that I was thinking of Northeastern species in particular, you know, that one would fail its size, I guess, and probably get buried in the soil just to keep it from freezing straight through.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think that's also kind of an important point that you're bringing it up is, you know, some people I know that they bring in their plants, people who get like a long freeze during the winters, they'll bring their plants in to overwinter. I'm very lucky that I can just keep mine out year round. But if you plant species that are, you know, hardy to those kinds of temperatures, and if you, I would think if you plant them into the ground, or even the pot into the ground, that would protect it a lot more, because I guess the issue would more so be the roots freezing and all that. But I would assume like the orchids would do just fine, like the purpurea would do just fine. Because I mean, I didn't even, you know, when I went to the bog last year in Minnesota, I was like, oh, I didn't even know, because I mean, they get freezing temperatures up there too for long periods of time, and a lot of that stuff does just fine. So I guess if it is in a pot, you would want to somehow, you know, prep it by putting it into the ground to try to protect those roots from the freeze, or bring it in, you know, somewhere that's not a heated area, because that could dry out the soil quickly, just to overwinter it while in dormancy, and that would probably protect it from the frost too, being indoors, or the freezing.
Yeah. And so that was, I was thinking like in one way I would have like I have a little spring behind my house.
Okay.
And it's, you know, it's water that's running down from a wetland that's sort of up above me. Mm-hmm. And I've been wanting to put in like, you know, a little bog garden on the side there.
Yeah. Yeah.
And have that be sort of native carnivorous plants. And this year's species is really pretty, and then the sabbatia. But then having, you know, a bog garden inside in sort of that, the situation you're talking about with plants that aren't native to the Northeast, that would sort of be blooming right now. I would love to have plants blooming right now in a bog garden and be seeing all that stuff inside. So I can see having like two of those situations where one, you're just knowing that those are the natives, dividing those species that way so that one can stay outside over the winter.
Right. Yeah.
And then the other one you can sort of enjoy year round.
Exactly. Yep.
I was going to ask you about something else. So we have the container. Let's talk about long-term care.
Okay.
So what would you recommend for, you know, is there a long-term care like regimen that you need to go through in order to keep these plants healthy for, you know, 5 or 10 years?
I would say, you know, pests, just look out for pests. Everyone's pest situations kind of differ depending on where they live. So I think pests would be the big thing, and the water too. You don't want to let the pots dry out obviously is going to stress out the plants, or it could, you know, cause wilt, which causes even more stress. A lot of people, when the Sarracenia, they go dormant, the pitchers are going to die back. And you can cut those back down pretty, about maybe, you know, leave about probably an inch or two left of the pitcher at the bottom. You don't want to cut it all the way back to invite, you know, like bacterial growth or any kind of fungus or anything from getting into the plant if you cut it too close to the ground. You know, you can, like, for like the yellow-eyed grass, sometimes I just pluck out the spent flowers oftentimes because they stay on there after they've flowered and stuff for a while. And then since I don't get a lot of rain here, my pygmy sundews, when they get the gemma production in the winter, I usually have to take some sort of tool to flick those off and just flick them off into the soil close by for them to sprout up from there. If you have a lot of rain, then the rain will take care of that and trigger the gemma to pop off the plant. But other than that, I don't really do much maintenance. These plants are pretty low maintenance. They're definitely a very just type of deal where, you know, you enjoy them, you know, you keep them watered, they feed themselves, you don't have to worry about fertilizing them, unless you have them indoors and you can fertilize them using a diluted fertilizer that you put into the trap mechanism itself and not into the soil. But other than that, I don't do much maintenance, really. Unless you don't want stuff to flower, you can cut the flowers off so they focus more of their energy on producing new traps. But that's about it, really. I'm kind of hovering over each one to see if there's anything that I would think, but no. Because, I mean, a lot of them die back for dormancy, and then they'll regrow again, and it's kind of very simple to maintain.
Okay. It's really interesting that you just said that you don't water the roots of the plant with your diluted fertilizer. You put it right into the pitcher.
Right, yeah. So you don't want to do it into the soil because that fertilizer will accumulate in the soil, and that's going to damage and then eventually kill the plant itself. Since they don't uptake their nutrition from the roots. So say for like Sarracenia, so people, like the popular brand of fertilizer is like Maxi, M-A-X-S-E-A, and they'll dilute it to about, I think, like a fourth teaspoon per gallon of like distilled water, rainwater, reverse osmosis. And then for like Sarracenia, you could take like an eyedropper, uptake it into the eyedropper, and then put it down into the trap. But I find that's maybe more so if you grow them indoors. But like my outdoor ones, I mean, when they have traps, and especially in the summer, my patio is like right by my garbage can, so it gets a lot of flies coming by, which is, I mean, it's perfect location because then it keeps the fly population down for me. But they feed themselves if they're outdoors oftentimes, and you don't really have to worry about that. And I also have some that I don't really even fertilize that I have indoors, like my Nepenthes. Every now and then I'll find a bug outside and pluck them into a pitcher, but I don't. Maybe it would make a difference if I tried fertilizing them with like a diluted fertilizer a long time and see the results, but they don't really have any stunted growth that I've seen. But I'm definitely no expert in continuous fertilization of carnivorous plants that don't get bugs and all that. So,
yeah, no, I think that makes perfect sense. If they're outside, they're getting all the nutrients they need from any bugs they're capturing.
Right. Yeah.
What about like you know, is, are you replacing peat moss at any point as it sort of decomposes, or?
So I haven't had to do that yet. I haven't had them. These bogs are probably, I think this is going to be their second full season of growth. So I'm sure the soil line might have gone down a little bit. But I think they're not quite old enough to where I've seen like a huge sinking of soil from decomposition. But I would think at some point you would probably have to, gosh, I haven't thought that far ahead about that part, on how you would add it, because I would imagine you would have to kind of redo it, pull out your plants and replenish the peat moss on top and then repop them in into it again. Because obviously, like the Sarracenia, you don't really want to keep the rhizomes buried underneath the soil level. You want them kind of popped out a little bit, kind of like with strawberries, you don't want to bury the crown. So I would imagine that you might have to do some, you know, pretty heavy duty repotting maintenance to replenish some of that peat moss once it gets to that point. But this is the going on the second growing season. I haven't noticed any super compaction. Yeah, with my peat moss.
Yeah, I mean, in one of, you know, I guess in the natural habitat of that, you know, when you walk out on a bog, that peat moss is usually pretty intact because it's so acidic.
Right.
That it sort of doesn't break down, you know, anaerobic
right.
environment.
Yeah, and I guess it is pretty, I mean, I guess that's part of the issue with peat moss harvesting is it takes so long for it to, you know, regenerate itself. I think I heard almost like less than a millimeter a year it will produce more peat. So I guess maybe in that aspect then it's already a slow decomposer. So I guess that's something I'll find out in the coming years, how, you know, at what point do I need to repot all of these plants. And at that point maybe I do put them into a bigger one and kind of attempt to transport the chunk that it's already in and just place that into a bigger one.
Yeah.
So that should be interesting to find out.
Have you done any reading about the Jemmy or anything like that? Cause that it's really interesting to me that these plants, the Drosera especially, do that.
Yeah. So I read about it. So I have two books. One is Growing Carnivorous Plants. I think it's by Dr. Barry Rice. He's a very well-known carnivorous plant grower. And I think he's, where is he based out of? I think he's a professor at a university somewhere. I can't think of it right now. And he even has like an online source, Sarracenia.com. That has a lot of really good information for free just on all the different genus and species also within those genus. And also the Savage Garden, which is, gosh, I'm drawing a blank. The founder of California Carnivores. I don't know. I'm drawing a blank on the name. But that book, very informational. Too. That one's probably like if you want to, you know, find out about carnivorous plants, that one is written very well. It's not super scientific. So, you know, someone without a background in horticulture or botany would be able to understand it. And so that's where I learned about Gemma. And it is very interesting how, you know, they can do that reproduction that way. And it comes in the winter time as the light levels start to shorten, as weather starts to cool, and they produce a bunch of Gemma. And then for me, I usually will just flick them off, just with some sort of like pokey tools, like a toothpick would work really well. Or if you have rainy winters, the rain when it's it seems like it does it when the rain is hard enough to do it. It will, and I guess that's how it's done in their natural habitat in Australia. The water hits it, and they're spring-loaded. So once that water hits it, it shoots off the gemma, and it lands somewhere, and then it sprouts a new pygmy sundew. So since we just got past winter over here, or I guess we're still technically in winter, but past gemma season, I have a bunch of new pygmy sundews just kind of carpeted. And they just, as they get bigger, you'll just have a beautiful display of just pygmy sundew kind of everywhere.
Is that's Scirpodes?
Yeah, so that is one of the species. And there's others like Micrantha.
And are they all doing this asexual reproduction?
Yes. Yeah, so from what I understand, all pygmy sundew, they do this form of asexual reproduction through gemma. And then I know there's a temperate species of Pinguicula. I think it's I think it might be Grandifolia. I don't know if I'm saying that right. And it also produces gemma too. I don't
Grandiflora.
Grow. Yeah, that one. And I don't grow that one. I know California Carnivores sells that one, but I would like to grow that one just because, I mean, the gemma are real easy if you get them off the plant at a good timing, then they will sprout a new plant. And so, I mean, it's, you know, if you're not good at growing them from seed, I think gemma is the way to go for pygmy sundew, because it's pretty much going to be a 100% success rate.
Now, are those in different families, Pinguicula and Drosera? They are, yeah. Drosera is in its Droseraceae. Pinguicula is in Lentaburlariaceae.
Okay.
It blows my mind that that plants do that, first of all.
Right.
And that they're carnivorous plants that do that.
Right.
So it makes me wonder what the... It's got to be something to do with the nutrient content, or, you know, they've evolved these two different ways to reproduce in order to make sure that they're getting offspring out there, or even their own genetics, even if it's a clone.
Right, yeah. I know the pygmy sundew, like their native range in Australia, I mean, they get those really hot summers and then they get the wet winters, and they still flower, and I'm pretty sure that they produce seed, but I don't know if that's just an easier way for them to make sure that they're, you know, cloning themselves by producing the gemma, since they live in such an extreme type of environment out there.
Yeah. Really interesting. I wonder if the species that I'm used to here do that. Maybe it's just the pygmy ones. But you'd think that if they were in the same genus, Drosera, that genetic possibility is there somewhere, unless they, you know.
Yeah.
You know, maybe it's a epigenetic thing that gets turned on with certain kinds of environments or environmental factors.
Right. Yeah.
Really cool. So that carnivorous plant nursery sells gemma. You can buy Drosera gemma and start plants that way.
So California Carnivores, they don't sell gemma, but I do believe I saw some gemma for sale on Carnivorous Plant Nursery. And I know carnivorousplantresource.com, they have kind of like a variety of sellers. And I know I've seen gem on there, and even on Etsy, like I bought my Drosera Scorpioides gemma from there just last year. And I mean, they were very healthy. I mean, the reviews were good for it too, so it was definitely a reputable seller. But you can definitely source Gemma, and you know, just put them on top. You don't need to bury them like for seeds. Just put them on top of mixture of wet, like just peat moss and horticultural sand mix. Give them some light, and they'll start to sprout into a new pygmy sundew. And then once it rolls around to winter again, those pygmy sundews should be producing their own Gemma that you can just, you know, flick off and spread, you know, some more pygmy sundew too.
That's all. I think we should just say here that, you know, those, that Carnivorous Plant Nursery and those other places, they say on their website that they're sourcing plants from existing plants in their nursery, either from seed or,
right,
you know, cutting. So they're not doing any wild harvesting of plants.
No.
Because a lot of these plants are rare or threatened in their local
right.
habitat or globally threatened. So that's, you know, that's good that they're sort of not adding to that issue.
Right. Yeah. The conservation issue. Yeah. So I mean, it's always good to know of reputable sellers, because I mean, a lot of these, like, you can find like fly traps at like a local nursery, but to find, you know, like all these hybrids of Sarracenia and companion plants and the Utricularia, a lot of those aren't main, like, quote unquote mainstream popular plants. So you often have to go online to find those. But luckily there are quite a few reputable online nurseries that sell these, that don't, you know, poach them or harvest them from the wild.
Another point about, you know, so we've got our garden, our bog garden planted,
mm-hmm.
watered, the plants are in. What about sun during the day?
Pretty much most plants are going to want full sun. So that's at least 8 hours a day of full sun. You know, there's some that, you know, might want to tolerate a little bit more shade. Like, you have some warm temperate pinguicula, like planifolia, that want a little bit more kind of shady filtered light, partial sun type of deal. A lot of the bladderworts too, like I have Utricularia blanchettii, and that one kind of disappears for me if it's a lot of sun exposure, and then it comes more so when it's a little bit more shaded by the spring and summer growth of other plants.
Mm.
But I would say a good percentage of these want full direct sun. And I mean, they can really take heat too. So even on, you know, very hot sun, I don't have any scorching issues with my plants at all, any, you know, sunburn or sun scorch on mine. And it can get pretty hot here in the summer in the 90s. So for pretty much most of these, like the Sarracenia, the Drosera, your companion plants, the fly traps, those are going to want full sun at least 8 hours a day. And obviously when they're dormant, and the days are shorter, that's not really going to affect much at all. But to get like that really good coloration out of them, it's going to be, you know, you want a lot of sun to really bring out, you know, those reds out of them.
Hmm. Cool. Is there anything else that like we need to know? I feel like I have a good grasp of the concept. Of how to get from a pot to a bog garden.
Right.
Are there any other pitfalls that I should look out for along the way?
I don't think so. I mean, I find them to just be very low maintenance, easy plants. they're just a lot of, I find them just to be a lot of fun. They're my least stressful plant, or, you know, types of plants that I have, compared to, you know, some of my more other high maintenance ones. I mean, so it's just kind of, you know, just have fun with it. You know, try like a variety, or you can do like a very specific, like location type of bog. You know, as long as you keep up with just the watering and making sure that they have that water that they're sitting in, that's really, they're just going to, and you give them enough light, they're going to flourish. I mean, they really take care of themselves as long as you just provide them with enough light and water.
So you're in a pretty dry place. How often are you watering those gardens that you have?
So we've had a lot of Santa Anas out here. We've had a really dry and warm winter. So I was watering on some days when the humidity drops to like 10%, probably every day been watering them. And then when the humidity starts to kind of pick up in the spring and summer, then I water them a little bit less. But then when we get into like August and September, those are our hottest months. And then if there's a lot of humidity, I'm still watering them a lot because it's just so hot out, probably every day, just topping off on the water. But when we have a wet winter, it fills it up and I don't have to worry about it for a few days or, you know, a few weeks. So that's always nice. But this winter has been hot and dry and not too much rain.
Yeah, that's, I think about that. Like I try to set myself up for the least amount of, you know, effort as possible.
Right.
I think what I'm going to do is I'll probably take one of those, a bigger size pot and bury it in the ground next to that mm-hmm. spring and then yeah. have that be sort of the flooding mechanism.
Right. Yeah. I mean, that would work perfectly.
Yeah. And then sort of transplant some established plants in there and see if I can get something started.
Yeah.
I'm really excited, man. I really appreciate you taking the time to talk to me about this.
Oh, yeah. And thank you for inviting me. Instagram's my only platform that I post. It's the Bog Boy. I post photos about weekly, and sometimes I slack off and maybe I miss a week, but I enjoy nature photography too. So it's a lot of, you know, pictures of my plants and sometimes updates on there about my bogs and all of that. So that's pretty much the only platform that I'm on right now.
Did you get your delivery?
Moxie.
Oh yeah. Yeah. It came earlier today. Yep. Thanks again.
So yeah, you're welcome, man. So you've never tried Moxie before?
No, I've never tried it or never heard it until I was reading Stephen King's, was it like, I think 11/22/63 book, which takes place in Maine. So then I was like, oh, must be out New England.
Yeah, it is. I went on a little deep dive a couple days ago. I mean, that soda has been around for a long time. I think it says like 1883 or 1886 on the bottle. And it was originally made with gentian root extract and another extract of some plants from South America. And it was like a competitor to Coca-Cola. But it was made by a Mainer, but it was originally produced in Lowell, Massachusetts, which is where I was born.
Okay.
So it's like a hometown favorite for me. I grew up like my dad, you know, buying that at the convenience store. And for some reason it is, you know, people either say it's,
can't stand this crap, and people that can barely tolerate it,
you know, like motor oil or like cough syrup is a really famous description of what it tastes like. But I don't know. I've always really liked the bitterness of it. But so today you're going to try your first Moxie.
Yep.
All right.
Yeah, let me just, I just need to grab it from the fridge. I put it in the fridge when it came.
Are you doing a glass or are you doing it straight out of the bottle?
I'm doing a glass, or should I do it straight out?
Do it in a glass. That's classy.
Okay. Oh, that's good.
This is pretty good.
It kind of has almost, reminds me, kind of has like a licorice-y, but like very subtle.
Oh, yeah, that's the other thing that they used to put in it was sassafras bark.
Oh, okay.
And so that, and you know, since, I don't know when they banned it, but they banned the use of sassafras because it was a carcinogenic compound.
Oh, okay.
And I think you can also get, you know, MDMA derivatives from the sassafras plant.
Huh.
So there's some sort of like, you know, the government's always trying to crack down on any sort of plant that they don't have a patent on.
All right.
Well, that's cool, man. I'm glad that that got to you okay. I told the people at the post office that it was maple syrup because I don't know if you can actually ship like a carbonated beverage on a, it probably went on a plane.
Oh, yeah.
And so it, you know, it went like 2-day air or something.
Yeah, I mean, it arrived, there was no, didn't explode, so.
Yeah, that's good. I didn't think it would. I thought it'd get through okay. The final question is, on a scale of 1 to 10, Moxie, in your review, gets a?
I would give it a 10. It's
good. All right. Yeah. All right. You're living on the wrong coast, man.
Right.
Awesome. All right, man. Well, thank you so much, Greg. I appreciate it.
Yeah, no, thank you. This was a lot of fun.
Yeah, it was really fun. And we should do it again sometime.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I'm definitely down.
Okay. Enjoy the rest of that Moxie, man.
All right. I will.
I will see you.
All right. Thank you. Have a good one.
Yep. Bye.
Next time I'm up there in Yankee Land, I'll get me some of this.